you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 71 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister.
Myself, Mark Tocton, barrister and editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always. And last week, you will recall, Mark, we had an interview with Des Geraghty, trade unionist, politician, Shannon singer, biographer of Luke Kelly. And we also talked about the Sinn Féin funds case from the 1940s.
Yeah,
Did you enjoy that interview?
Absolutely. It was really interesting. Yeah.
That was really good. I thought it was fantastic. Folks, if you missed it, please listen back because it's really, really good. Clio is the leading provider of cloud-based legal practice management software, providing lawyers with an easy-to-set-up, affordable solution to manage and grow your firm more effectively, more profitably, and with better client experiences. Start a free trial today. Visit clio.com/IE. Well, today we are going to be talking to UCD academic Dr. Charles Garavan, who's going to talk to us about the Apple case and the EU. And there's a decision pending from the EU later this year, I think, following on from the Advocate General. And Charles is going to tell us all about that. But he's a fascinating character in many ways.
Absolutely.
I mean, as well as a brilliant academic, and he is a brilliant academic.
Yeah, a whole background as a memory man.
The memory man. And also a debater.
I think so, yeah. I think he held the world record for 46 hours.
Oh, I am so looking forward to this interview. It's going to be fantastic. But first, we're going to go to three cases that you have identified from the Decisus website. The first case this week concerns a habeas corpus application concerning a person detained under the mental health legislation. The question was whether the failure to complete the relevant forms or documents rendered the detention unlawful. This is the case of YZ versus clinical director of the Department of Psychiatry in a certain hospital, which is not identified, and it's a decision of Ms. Justice Nuala Jackson.
That's right. So it's, as you said, it's a habeas corpus action arising from a detention under the Mental Health Act. And generally speaking, the courts are quite tolerant of omissions if the underlying reason for detaining the person is upheld. But in this particular case, certain information was simply omitted by the doctor, and Ms. Justice Jackson held that that wasn't sufficient and it couldn't be rectified. And so she granted habeas corpus.
Okay, super, Mark. Okay. Second case concerns a personal injuries action involving a workplace accident in a hospital. The claim was dismissed in the Circuit Court and was appealed to the High Court. This is Redmond versus Talla University Hospital, and it's a decision of Mr. Justice O'Higgins.
Yeah, so this case started in the Circuit Court and the plaintiff's case was dismissed. What happened was she was an employee and she was lifting a metal tray of instruments onto a storage rack. And essentially, by the nature of the stacks of trays was such that she, first of all, managed to, I think, spear her finger on a loose wire, and then there was a collapse of the stack of trays, causing an injury. And although she was clearly partially responsible for the accident, it was held that the hospital did have a responsibility, and so the quantum of damages, in fact, had been agreed, and so Mr. Justice O'Higgins in the High Court held that she was entitled to recover part of
the... So the moral of the story is Circuit Court harsh, High Court generous, maybe?
This particular case, yes.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, very interesting. Finally, an application for a European arrest warrant in respect of a person convicted of driving while disqualified. This concerned a Czech national who was wanted back in the Czech Republic to serve a sentence, I think, of 7 months, Mark.
Yeah, and it always seems very harsh to return somebody for a relatively light sentence, but the Czech Republic had sought his return, and because it complied with an equivalent offence in this jurisdiction, the High Court ordered his return to the Czech Republic to serve the balance of his sentence.
Okay, wow. And I should say, this is the Minister for Justice against Brazda, and it's a decision of Ms. Justice Melanie Greeley. Okay, so back shortly with Dr. Charles Garavan.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
So we're very pleased to be joined in the studio this afternoon by Charles Garavan, who is a lecturer in tax law and company law in the business school in UCD. We're here to talk about the Apple case, which is pending before the European courts. Before you get onto that, there's two things I'd like to ask you about. First of all, in my researches, I discovered that you have a reputation as a memory man. How did that come about?
I got, my father gave me a book written by a magician, Harry Lorraine, and Harry Lorraine's whole act was memory stunts. And he had written How to Develop a Superpower Memory in the 60s, which my father still had a tattered copy of and gave to me when I was about 16. And I could do sort of silly little tricks with it, but I couldn't use it for anything practical. I just forgot about it. And then I read in the back page of the Sunday Times magazine, A Day in the Life of Dominic O'Brien, who was the world memory champion. And he had written a book, and his technique seemed to be a bit different from what Harry Lorraine was doing. So I got really interested in that whole area. And there I was, I guess I was studying for exams at the time as a post-postgrad, in that I was practicing at the bar and I was doing the tax exams. And probably for the first time in my life, I actually started to think, what are exams about? Like, what is success and what's failure? And why is it hard to remember some things? And what's the best way to study? And I managed to come up with a way of studying that was pretty successful. For me anyway. And then I worked in tax for a while and I left and decided to run a business teaching these techniques. So at the start, it was mostly those memory techniques for learning off. You
is
know,
this kind of memory words. Palace technique?
It's kind of like thing? A memory right, palace okay. type thing. So what's
Dominic, a memory palace?
Okay, so what Dominic O'Brien had done was really rediscover a much older system of techniques, which is what the Greeks and Romans did. And memory palace is one way of describing it, but probably journey is a better way. So the idea is that you would walk through a route that is familiar to you. And at each stage on that route, you would see visual images to remind you of whatever key words there were. So if you were a Roman orator and you wanted to remember a speech, you might say that there is a danger of an uprising, and in your bedroom you might see peasants breaking loose of their chains, and then you would move to the next bit to say that the emperor must take control, and then you might picture the emperor forcing these guys onto the ground or something. And then when you meant to make your speech, you would mentally walk through this journey, and if you had come up with bizarre and colourful and interesting images, they would remind you of what you wanted to say.
But according to this article, you could remember lists of sort of 4,000 items. I mean, that's a very long journey to remember.
It is a very long journey, or a series of shorter journeys. And really, what there are world memory championships and there are other memory competitions, and they memorise binary numbers and random numbers and the order of a pack of shuffled cards and things. But all of it comes down to turning what you're trying to remember into images and then just putting them along this.
And you've never written
journey.
A book on this?
I did write a book, actually, yes.
It's still available
how
on
to,
this?
Yes, on how to learn and remember for Leaving Cert, but it is now out of print.
I think
I'm
we
afraid.
Need to drill into this a bit more, Mark. I'm fascinated by this. I didn't know about this. It's all about you, Charles. You have so much more interesting things to say as well, but just we have to go with this. So you're doing this competition to become the memory man. I used to think that was Jimmy McGee. Do you remember the great Jimmy McGee?
Yes,
in terms of sport, God rest him. But anyway, so just in terms of the competition, what are you trying to remember?
Well, it depends on the competition, but usually there's 10 different events. So one of them would be memorizing decimal numbers on rows of 25 and as many as you can remember in an hour. With an hour and a half for recall. And, you know, if you make one mistake in a line, you get half marks. And if you make two mistakes, you get zero. So there are people who've done, you know, 2,000, 3,000.
Lines of numbers in sequence and getting
well,
right.
Of digits, thousands of digits.
Digits, yeah.
So memorizing a pack of cards as fast as you can. About the best I ever did at home was about 75 seconds, which at the time, if I'd done it in competition, would have been respectable. Now it wouldn't get you in the top 100. There are people who do it in 20 seconds.
Wow.
Which is about as fast as you can look
at. And this is different from a photographic memory, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think there is any such thing as a photographic memory, really. Not in the sense that people mean. So there are some people who have a photographic memory in terms of art and being able to repaint an image that they've seen. But nobody has the ability to read a page of text and close their eyes and read it back. Yeah. There's never really been any evidence that anyone can do that. So, no, this is just a trick, but only part of what I was teaching was really about that. And more I found that it was actually what people were doing when they sat down to study and what they thought they were trying to achieve that was very flawed. So I would talk to them more about, as an examiner now, a person who's set and corrected a lot of exams, that if you don't know what the examiner's marking scheme looks like, then you haven't really thought about this at all. And, you know, you should be trying to produce the answer that looks exactly like the answer in their head, and your study should be focused on that, not saying, I'm going to learn all the stuff and then hope that I can somehow fit it in to the question that I get asked on the day. So lots of things like that is sort of, and how to actually study in terms of testing yourself.
I could have done with a few of those tips all those years ago, Mark. My daughter is here present. She's a transition year student. Katie May, I hope you're listening to all this and taking it on board. Anyway, thank you, Charles. Yeah, I'll let Mark go back to the proper interview.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to move on to the Apple case, which is why we've invited you in.
Sure.
So I suppose people will be aware that currently sitting in an escrow account, 13 billion, I think, euro, that Apple has, the European Commission argues that Apple should be paying to the Irish state, and the Irish state is going to the ends of the earth to try and prevent accepting. And I think certain people like Fintan O'Toole have said that we ought to be accepting it, and Sinn Féin have more or less said that we ought to be accepting it. We'll see if they get into power, whether they do. But maybe you can just talk our listeners through what actually happened here. And I think the background is that Apple started manufacturing in Ireland in the 1970s, was it?
1980.
1980.
So we had a tax relief called export sales relief, which was introduced in 1956. It was one of Lamassa's sort of big ideas to get foreign direct investment. And ironically, when we joined the European Union, they said, this is clearly state aid, and I'll come back to what that means. And so the last year you could avail of it was 1980. And if you were manufacturing and exporting in 1980, you got a 10-year essentially tax holiday. You didn't pay tax on any of your profits from exporting. So in 19...
So this is materials manufactured in Ireland but exported and you didn't pay tax.
Well, this was our whole strategy was let's create jobs.
Yeah.
So not let's create tax revenue or let's wash revenue through here somewhere else and take a slice off it. We essentially said, we don't care if you ever pay tax, just please come here and create some jobs so that people have some work and they don't have to emigrate. And so in 1990, Apple for the first time would have been paying corporation tax. Now, what Apple had was these two companies that carried out some activities in Ireland through what we call a branch. We don't have a real definition of it, but let's just call it a branch. And under Irish law, you were only taxed on the profits from the branch. And so the question that Apple was faced with was, how do we determine what are the profits that are earned from the branch? In particular, because everything that got manufactured was being sold to another Apple company, and there were a lot of services being provided, sort of back-end services for Apple companies. So they went to revenue and said, what we propose doing is using a form of markup. What we'll do is we'll take the costs of the branch and we'll add on a margin as profit. And that's what we'll declare as our profit and pay tax on. And Irish Revenue said that seems fairly reasonable given the activities that are being carried out.
So this sounds like an accounting exercise as much as anything else.
It is,
There's activity that's operating in Ireland. And I think some of it's logistics, isn't it? I mean, they're basically...
Yeah, there's a number of different things that are going on. And the question is how much of that is driven by the employees and the assets and everything else that are in Ireland. And so, in 1990, there were no transfer pricing rules. There were no rules about internationally. There was no best practice about how you determined the profits of a branch compared to what we'll call the rest of the company, the head office. And so Revenue's approach seems, honestly to me, to be pretty reasonable. They updated it that in around 06, 07. And then this issue came to a head when the background is that a lot of large multinationals were shifting profits to low tax and zero tax places. And one of the ways they were doing it was through their intellectual property. So these two Apple companies, the head offices, because they're not resident companies, I should say, they're non-resident companies. That's why they're only taxed on the branch. They owned all of the intellectual property for Apple Inc. outside of the Americas. And so they are receiving massive amounts of royalties. And that's where the billions and billions and billions have been earned.
They're being, it's being generated to the Irish branches?
No, not to the branches, to the head office.
Through the Irish branches?
Not through the Irish branches at all. So the Irish branches just exist and they do their own thing. And then other companies all over the world are paying royalties to these Apple companies for the use of their intellectual property. And that money might never come near Ireland or touch the hands or come under the eye of a single Irish person.
But it's assessed in Ireland for the purposes of revenue.
Is not, that it? No.
No,
no, because these companies aren't resident in Ireland. So let's say you're BMW and you decide that you're going to open a small marketing base in Dublin. You will only be taxed on the profits of that marketing base.
Yes.
Because you're a Bavarian company, you're resident in Germany. No one's going to be taxing you on the selling Volkswagens. And this is essentially the same thing that we're saying, well, under our law, we can only tax the profits from the activities in the branch. And what happens in the rest of the company is nothing to do
but
with
what
us.
What you've said there, Charles, maybe I've got this completely wrong, but, you know, it is not in relation to the Apple companies that were branches here in Ireland. They were generating whatever they were generating and making some profit, I presume. You know, but you're talking about the whole world and the intellectual property that's kind of flying around the globe is somehow seems to be centered in Ireland. And therefore, no, is
well,
that not it? No.
Well, not in Ireland. And so here's another wrinkle for you.
Well, then why are we the bad guys then?
Well, I'll get to it. another wrinkle to this is that these are Irish incorporated companies, but they were not tax resident in Ireland. And the reason for that was a mismatch between how we define corporate residence and how the United States does. So in the United States, if you incorporate your company in the United States, you form it under the laws of the United States, that is a U.S. company and it's taxed on its worldwide income, regardless of where it's earned. In Ireland at the time, the test was whether you were managed and controlled in Ireland, whether your central management and control, your strategic management at director level. And so it was very easy to set up a stateless company. What you would do is you would incorporate your company in Ireland, as Apple did, and you would manage and control it in Cupertino, in California. And then the US would say, not a US company, and Ireland would say, not an Irish company.
And am I right thinking that the residency rules in Ireland are pretty similar to those in most of the rest of the EU?
Well, that was similar. It was exactly the same as the United Kingdom. Now, they changed their rules a little earlier than we did. And really not because of tax reasons, but because of reputational damage. And in 1994, we did the same thing. So what we did was we said, there are Serbian warlords that have Irish incorporated companies. And people are doing business with them, assuming that these are regulated in Ireland and that there's some supervision, and there wasn't. So we changed our company law so that you couldn't form a company here unless you did business here, or you had a director resident in the EEA or the EU. And for tax purposes, we said, if you are incorporated in Ireland, you're resident in Ireland, but if you're already carrying on a trade here, or you have a related company carrying on a trade, then you can stay as you were. Because you're already doing business here, so you're not causing us reputational damage. So it wasn't a tax-driven decision. Now, that created what was known as the double Irish.
Yes, the famous double Irish, yeah.
And the reason it was a double was that you would create one company that was Irish incorporated and managed and did and had a trade, and then one company that was incorporated and managed abroad, and that held the intellectual property. That's what Google did. And ironically, if Apple had done that, there would have been no state aid case remotely possible that could have been taken.
Okay, let's go back to the European Union and the Commissioner, Martha Vertager.
Mm-hmm.
How do you pronounce it?
I've never been entirely sure either.
Okay. So she says, I've had enough of this Irish carry-on.
Right.
Okay. And Ireland, you know, has been given Apple a pass. Apple have been generating massive, 100 billion, you know, in profits, and not a cent is being seen. And Ireland have been, you know, have not done what they should have done in relation to this. And we are now imposing a fine, effectively. You know,
It's not really a fine. What it is they say that you must collect the tax you should have collected.
Yes.
Now, I suppose a little bit on state aid rules.
So a failure to charge or whatever. Yeah.
If I'll give you a little bit of state aid rules and then talk about how the Commission says state aid rules apply to what I've outlined as the structure. So state aid rules effectively are rules that say that you cannot provide grants or financial assistance to support particular companies or particular sectors of the economy. And this is to prevent distortion of competition. And everyone in the EU has signed up to these state aid rules. And early enough in the history of the union, it was decided by the courts that by giving someone a tax break, you were in effect giving them a grant. It was identical, that instead of giving them money, you just reduced their tax bill. And so what the European Commission did was they tried to address this idea that really arose from mismatches in international law. And they thought, well, one way to attack this is to use state aid. So they said that when Ireland told Apple that it only had to pay tax on a markup basis based on costs in Ireland, that was a special deal that wasn't available to others and that it lowered their tax liability and that therefore that amounted to a grant paid to Apple. And so they said you need to collect the tax. Now, the problem with that is that they almost entirely ignored what Irish law actually says, which they're not entitled to do, because Irish law says you can only tax the profits from the branch. And if no one worked in Ireland has ever had anything to do with the intellectual property, they've never managed it, they've never licensed it, they've never collected the money from it, they had nothing to do with the agreement or the amendments of the agreement.
And I suppose it's important to say, Charles, that each EU state has autonomy over their own tax regulation.
Exactly. So we decide on our tax rules, they must comply with the treaties, and so we can't breach free movement of goods and free movement of workers, and we can't breach state aid rules. And so the EU had a number of real problems with applying state aid rules in this situation. So one of them was that Ireland argued that even if you used the OECD's guidelines on how you attribute profit between a head office and a branch, you would have reached the same conclusion. And the Commission said, well, we are not following the OECD rules. First of all, they said domestic rules are irrelevant because the idea of an arm's length price is inherent in state aid. And then they said, what we mean by arm's length is not what everyone else thinks it means. It's a special meaning that allows us to say that since the head office has no staff and no people that could manage the IP, it must be managed in Ireland and therefore it should be taxed in Ireland.
Just to move it on slightly, okay? Mm-hmm. So Margareta Vertager, I'm pronouncing that, Vertager or whatever, I'm pronouncing the name all wrong. I noticed Mark hasn't jumped in to correct me, so he doesn't know either.
Well, I don't know, yeah. I should say I don't have an opinion.
Anyway, so she says, you know, Ireland, there you go, there's 13 billion in revenue. I think that might build a few houses or a few hospital beds or something like that. But what does Ireland do? It gets together its leading legal team. It brings in Paul Gallagher, former Attorney General, Maurice Collins, who's a Supreme Court judge. And, you know, it puts together this incredible legal team in order to fight the EU, and we don't want the money. Now, why are we doing that? People say, we don't want to mess up all this stuff with the foreign direct investment and we want the jobs and, you know, look at all the money we're getting anyway. But why are we doing that? Why do we take such a strong line in relation to this?
Well, I think, first of all, there is that point that you have to defend your own tax system and the autonomy of that tax system. And so you have to be able to go to Apple and say, we're not going to leave you on your own here, and not defend what we told you was correct and what we still believe is correct in Irish law and say, but we'll take your money even though we don't think we're entitled to it. That is a problem in itself. But secondly, if the EU were, or if the Commission was successful in expanding the idea of state aid so that it could effectively rewrite Irish law to include concepts that didn't exist at the time and that don't exist anywhere else, then that's going to cause a massive problem for sovereignty generally.
So it's effectively allowing them to rewrite tax laws throughout the EU, isn't it?
It potentially could, because essentially what they said was, Okay, in 1990, you didn't have transfer pricing rules and you didn't have this arm's length concept for how branches and head offices should work. But it exists in state aid and we've conjured it out of the ether, and therefore you should have applied it even though you've never heard about it. And if that is only one standard that they can use at state aid, then there could be many others where they could look at the 12.5% rate and say, we've determined that this must be a form of state aid. It's allowing them to encroach in sovereignty, I think. And Ireland is one of the countries that pushes very hard as a small country for keeping its entitlement to write its own tax laws.
But just in terms of, obviously, you know, you're talking about it from a legal point of view and, you know, our autonomy in terms of our own tax system and our right to legislate as how we see fit and how we see, you know, is appropriate in the context of our needs as a nation state. But ultimately, this is political, I would have thought. And A, we would appear to be at odds with our European neighbours. And I notice what you say there, Charles, that there are other nation states out there that are looking at this and saying, well, if they do it to Ireland, they can do it to us as well. I'm not really hearing that in terms of a kind of a European, sort of pan-European front in relation to this. I think we're kind of out on our own a little bit, aren't we?
I don't think we are at all. So, for instance, the Commission has also taking cases against the Netherlands, and the Netherlands has fought those cases along with the companies involved, as has Luxembourg. So we're not the only people who came in the crosshairs here. Starbucks, Amazon,
it's a particular
McDonald's.
Category of countries, though, isn't it? I mean, how do our dear friends in Slovakia and Cyprus and other countries feel about this?
Well, I haven't asked any lawyers over there personally about it, but I think you're probably wrong in terms of a concern amongst smaller nations about the idea of a tax grab by the larger ones. And so this is something that's been getting pushed for a long time. So the common consolidated corporate tax base has essentially been, as it's been seen, not just by Ireland, but by other countries, as an attempt for the larger countries like France and Germany to say, well, look, what we should do is you should file one tax return in the whole of the EU, and then you should share the revenue out based on population. So Ireland can say goodbye to most of its revenue because there's only 5 million of you, and France can say hello to a whole lot of it. And we have pushed back against that, but so has Belgium, so has the Netherlands, so has Denmark, Estonia, Latvia. Yeah. So I don't think we're on our own in terms of saying that we need to control our tax laws and we need to stop the Commission pushing itself forward as saying we're going to harmonize this whole thing one way or another. Now, in terms of it being political, I think you're right in that the Commission here was trying to deal with issues that are, I think, better dealt with by OECD and all countries working together. And that is what has been happening in the international space. I'm sure if I worked for the Commission, I'd be very frustrated to think that we have the power to create law, but we need unanimity and we can't get it. The OECD has no powers to do anything, and yet it gets 112 countries to sign up to a methodology for addressing multinationals not paying their fair share.
Charles, can I ask, where is the litigation now? Am I right in thinking the general court found in favour of Ireland, but now the Advocate General has found in favour of the Commission,
So the Commission has actually lost all of these cases, not just the Irish case. And the methodology that's been followed has been very similar in terms of saying that there's a self-standing notion of arm's length existing in state aid, and that's been firmly rejected. So the General Court rejected it. The Advocate General's decision is absolutely perplexing because it claims to be in conjunction with more recent decisions of the Court of Justice, but it is entirely at odds with it. So the Court of Justice has affirmed that if you don't have these rules in your national law, then the Commission can't just manufacture them and stick them in there. And the Advocate General said the most important thing is how you interpret Irish law. And then the only thing that was said about Irish law was, well, you had a sort of a notion of state aid or of arm's length somewhere in your tax code, so close enough.
Are other commentators taking the same view as you've just taken, that it's a perplexing decision, or is there support for it elsewhere?
This is the interesting thing about reading European law, is that there are a lot of federalists who consider national sovereignty to just be a temporary nuisance on the road to harmonizing everything. And so there have been plenty of people who've been cheering this on. But there are lots of people who have been scratching their heads looking at the Advocate General's decision because it is so at odds with what the Court of Justice
Charles,
has said.
We should explain to some of our listeners who might be up to speed with this. Okay, so we talked about the General Court of, and now it's gone to the Court of Justice. So there's two courts operating out in Luxembourg, basically, in the European Union. And in terms of the Court of Justice, we have an Advocate General who gives a preliminary opinion.
Yeah,
and that is what has happened here. Yes, it's a guy called Pitts Ruzella. I think I'm going to have an easier one to pronounce this guy.
Yes, it's not binding, but it is.
But it's generally followed. Well, this is the point by the Court of Justice.
It is followed, in about 75-80% of cases. But those are just the odds over a large number of cases. I don't know if you can say there's an 80% chance the court will follow this. My own feeling is that if the court follows what it has done in other recent cases, it will effectively say that the Advocate General has misread their opinion. And based on what they have said in other cases, there is no case for Apple to answer at all.
I think it's fairly clear where you stand on this particular case.
It is,
you haven't, you haven't hidden your views.
I'm not an iRegister by any manner or means, and I think the European Union has been great for us. But I do think the nature of things, bodies like the Commission, is to draw power to themselves.
Okay.
And it is important for someone to be watching and saying, well, we didn't sign up to that in the treaty, and that's not what we meant by state aid. And I think we have to draw a line here and say...
Mark, you want to come in there, but can I just ask one really question? What about the moral imperative here? I mean, you can say it's okay for us to do our own thing, and, you know, we're entitled to, you know, paddle our own canoe. We can be part of the wider European Union. But what about the moral imperative? Tim Cook, you know, CEO of Apple, makes 100 billion euros in profit and doesn't pay a penny in tax back to, you know, society which needs it, the social contract that we all participate in. And we could say, oh, well, you know, that wasn't domiciled and that wasn't resident and that was outside of the jurisdiction and it's all this sort of stuff. But I mean, is there some sort of moral failing in terms of the Irish tax system? Forget about, you know, the whole, you know, harmonising European tax laws. But should we be doing the right thing here?
Well,
Charles.
Yes and no. So, yes, in terms of that is an issue that needs to be addressed. And there is a real problem with the idea of allowing multinationals to effectively pay nothing because they can hire the best advisors and they can easily set up in any country and fix any price between that entity and another entity. To assume that, let's say, in the early 2000s, that Ireland should be the world's tax policeman and that they should draw the line and say, we won't take your money and watch it go somewhere else, just seems to me a little naive. We have signed up to a worldwide approach to this, and we have engaged fully with the OECD. That can't be said of plenty of other countries that have fought against this idea. So I think it would have been strange indeed to say this is all legally fine, but we have a moral objection, so go and set up your factory and your business somewhere else and we'll just go back to sending our people to go and live there.
And can I ask, do you think there's a danger if either, say, a new government was decide to stop defending this system or if the court found against Ireland, that suddenly the position of all of the pharmaceutical companies in Ireland and the tech companies would suddenly become a little bit more precarious, that they might be looking at our tax system a little bit more closely and going, well, maybe we should be setting up somewhere else?
Well, I've always believed that the core driver in terms of attracting multinationals with the tax rate, it's not the only way we attract people, but the core driver there was the certainty. So multinationals need certainty. They don't want to set up somewhere and not know what's happening in 5 years' time.
Yep.
And Britain have been shooting themselves in the foot a lot lately by saying they're going to drop their rate to 12. No, they're going to keep it at 25. They're going to move it to 18. I've always believed that if we had moved it from 12.5 to 13, let's say in 2009, when we were in serious trouble economically, that sends a message that next year it could be 30. And that totally changes the game. So I do think there's a danger that if we start to send the message that these things are not written in stone, that there's a problem. And if we say not only is it not written in stone, but we don't defend our own rules, and even though we tell you with one side of our mouth that we think that we've done or applied our rules correctly, at the other side we're saying we'll take the extra cash. One other thing I meant to say was when I was saying should Ireland be the world's policeman, it's very important to remember that the other side of this equation was the United States. And if they wanted to make these companies resident in the United States, they could have done it with the stroke of a pen. And they didn't, because it suited them. Because if Apple had earned all of that money in Ireland and paid 12.5%, when they repatriated the profits to the States, they would have had to give a credit for the Irish tax deducted. So they would get less tax. So America all along has been very happy with the idea that their multinationals are paying no tax in Europe, and they're waiting for the day when these hundreds of millions of cash piles get repatriated. We were the ones that came under the pressure to change our rules, and some of that came from America, but no one ever said America should just treat these as American companies, and that solves the problem. So if someone provided state aid to Apple, it was probably the United States.
Thank you for explaining that to us brilliantly, really, really brilliantly. And I think you believe that the Irish state has fought the good fight. And actually, if I can, I mentioned Maurice Collins and Paul Gallagher. If I could give a mention to an old classmate of mine, Juliana Quaney, who was the solicitor for the state in relation to the proceedings. So she was there with everybody else as part of it. We're at that stage, Mark, where I think we have to ask Charles, does he have a book?
Yes.
Can you remember a book?
I can remember a book. I'm
the whole text of it?
No, but I am going
to... What did it say on page 367?
I am going to read it again now that I've thought about it. It's one of the only books in the last 15 years I've read more than once. And it's A Guide to the Good Life by William Irvin, William B. Irving, who is Irvine, who is a professor of philosophy in the United States. And essentially what he has done is given an up-to-date version of what Stoic philosophy is and how to apply it. And Stoicism is not, as I thought, just grimly bearing misery. It is a way of thinking about the world that can bring genuine happiness. I definitely feel that it has improved my life trying to put into practice what he's said. It's very easy to read.
It's not an academic text, then.
It's not an academic text, no. And I tried to go back and read some of the source material, read Marcus Aurelius and Seneca and Epictetus. Oh, wow. I could never draw out of it what Irving has, and in such a simple way and such a compelling way in terms of how to apply it to your life. So I would say everybody should read that.
Well, A Guide to the Good Life. Okay.
We're all in favor of happiness and fairness, and I think you've explained that brilliantly, Charles.
So Charles, that's all been fascinating, but the memory and the Apple and the Guide to the Good Life. So thank you very much for joining us.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can I say a huge thank you to our guest, Charles Garavan, for that incredible explanation of the Apple case. High-level explanation, Mark,
I think I understand it a bit better
I
hope I listened to it.
What was
the
bit in the middle again?
Oh, that was the bit about
Charles was so impressive. And, you know, I mean, there's going to be a big decision later in the year. He doesn't necessarily think that the old Advocate General has got it correct.
Well, he certainly made it clear he doesn't agree with him, but I think he takes the view that the court is not necessarily going to follow the Advocate General in this case.
Yeah, but in 80% of cases they do. So we'll have to wait and see. Okay, before we go, I would like to say a big thank you to our producer, Conal O'Moroin, and also to Alison O'Dwyer from the Dublin South Podcast Studios for the wonderful work done in recording this show. So from me, Peter Leonard.
And myself, Mark Tolkien.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.